The lights are on red. We're away.
Hi, welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, May 30th, 2008, and this is episode 130 of the show. My name is Jules Cisek, and I'm filling in for Bob Hayes, who is out this week. Sorry for the show coming out about 12 hours late this week. I had some hardware issues last night when I sat down to edit, so it was a bit of a rush job this morning. But anyhow, let us do some listener email, some news, and then I'll play a call with Liam Schubert of the Alice Dantin MotoGP, a.k.a. Squadra della Pecora Nere, prior to his departure for Mugello. Okay, some listener email. Jason Watts from Down Under writes, in reference to that little story about Rossi being a bit wasted, or pissed as they say in the UK, the night before the race at Valencia in 2006, which we had on the show last week. He says, I'm a big Hayden fan. I've been 4 times to Phillip Island, and he's the nicest guy on the planet and a huge fan of the show. Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment on Jules' story about Rossi going out partying before the Valencia race. Rossi was only leading the championship by 8 points after Estoril, and I think you'll find if Hayden had won the race at Valencia and he was ready to overtake Bayless for the lead until he read his pit board, Rossi needed to finish second to win the championship, not eighth. So please, no more Hayden bashing. Jason, you're absolutely right. I misstated what I meant to say was simply that Rossi thought he had it in the bag with the pole position and all. I'm not even that keen on giving the story much heed, not because I don't think it's possible. It certainly is, but it belittles Hayden's achievements to say that on top of everything else that was said that year, he won the championship because Valentino got bombed the night before arguably the most important race of his career. But I do have to say that I don't think Hayden had it in him to catch the Ducatis. Those guys were in a different league that day. And even if he had caught them, those two, Bayless and Caparossi, are probably the hardest guys to pass in motorcycle racing. Tom Puro writes, I searched for a rule that outlawed helmet communication in MotoGP like they have in Formula One and many other auto racing events. Do you know if it's not allowed or why it's not used? I would think that any communication between a driver and the pit would be helpful if you are on 4 wheels or two. So here's the rule. It's in section 1.21, behavior during practice and race, paragraph 12. No signal of any kind may pass between a moving motorcycle and anyone connected with the motorcycle's entrant or rider, save for the signal from the timekeeping transponder, from onboard cameras, or legible messages on a pit board or body movements by the rider. Now, note that they don't mention body movements by the crew. So does that mean the crew is not allowed to pump their fists? Or in the case of Rossi at Estoril, waving him on, it's not over. I would also like to mention that episode 101, which is available at MotoGPOD.com, has a very interesting segment by David Emmett of Kropotkin Thinks about why ship-to-shore type communications in MotoGP are a terrible idea. It's a really good listen. So I suggest you check that out. Cliff Jones writes, Bob, you refer to the Ducati and quote, the fours as though the Ducati was anything other than a four-cylinder bike. As far as I know, the Ducati is a V4 and similar to the Honda, Suzuki, and Yamaha. It therefore shares the same engine configuration for at least half the field. So I think that V4s are really such rare beasts outside of MotoGP that I think, you know, when Bob says four, he means inline four. But there's actually more V4s in the sport. Not only the Yamaha and Kawasaki are inline fours. The Honda, Ducati, and Suzuki are V4s. So thanks for that, making a note of that and correcting us. Craig France writes, I watched the MotoGP race with Hopper breaking a chain, and I thought that I was nuts. I was trying to figure out how in the hell a chain would ever break. Then last Sunday at Beaver Run Motorsports Complex at a track day that I was coaching at, I came through one of the faster corners and my chain broke and locked around the rear axle, and the guy behind me hit me. We both went for a good ride after that and both walked away with just some sore spots. I've talked to 3 people that have had a chain break in the last year. It is not that uncommon as one might think. Just thought I would throw that one out. Thanks very much, Craig. That's interesting. I'm glad you didn't get hurt with the chain getting lodged in the rear. That's always like the thing that scares me the most about losing a chain is getting it locked up in there. It could have been a lot nastier, so I'm glad you guys are okay. I actually do think that chain failures are still very rare in MotoGP. This is actually the first year where I've seen 2 chain-related failures, and it might actually be the chance failing, but the sprocket. Remember the chain that jumped from Vermeulen's bike in China? That was actually a front sprocket problem. But that doesn't really matter which failed in the case of Hopper. The chain or the sprocket, because it's just the end result that matters. A chain snaking its way along the pavement and 0 points for Hopper. Okay, some news from MotoGP and other racing series. First, a very sad note. A 13-year-old American racer, Alex Escawa, was killed on Monday at Summit Point Raceway in West Virginia. The bike in front of him was seized. Crashed into it and then was hit from behind by another bike who had nowhere else to go. I'm very deeply saddened by the loss of such a young life, and our thoughts go out to the Lascawa family. Okay, in AMA Racing, we're getting some information about the new superbike class for 2009, and it's getting pretty bizarre. Now, the superbike class will include such bikes as the Aprilia Tuono, the new Buell 1125, the BMW HP2, very cool, the Ducati 848, but also like bikes like the Ducati S4R, the KTM Super Duke, the MV Brutale, Triumph Daytona, Yamaha R6, obviously, Suzuki 750 and 600 bikes. Anyway, that might sound a little bit insane, but you know, I would actually love to see some naked bikes out there. Note that this is a list of bikes eligible for homologation, i.e. the granting of approval by an official authority. And yes, I had to look that up. The purse for the series will be $50,000 for first place and then $5,000 for each place from 2nd to 20th, which is also a little bit bizarre. As some people have said, who wants to race for 2nd in a series like that? And then there's a so-called leader class, which will consist of the Aprilia RSV4, the BMW S1000RR, the Buell 1125R again, the 1098, the CBR Ninja 10R, the KTM RC8, which is their new race bike, the MV F4, Suzuki's Gixxer 1000, and the R1. I'm still trying to digest what all this means, but on the surface it really stinks. It's all really bizarre and confusing. In fact, I don't follow the AMA series enough to really understand these changes well enough to discuss, so we will have to talk about them on a later show. In the meantime, check out the links in the show notes, and please feel free to write in what you think about all this. You can email us at MotoGPOD@MotoGPOD.com. Don't forget, we've got World Superbike at Miller Sports Park this weekend. This is the first time World Superbike is in America since 2004 when they were at Laguna. This will likely be actually the last chance for Americans to see the great Troy Bayliss racing. If you get a chance to see the race, well, I'll be jealous. My son's turning 8 that day, so I'm tethered at home. I was actually planning to go, but obviously needed to change my plans there. And now some MotoGP news. Valentino Rossi is, quote, 90% ready to sign on a dotted line with Yamaha. Details are sketchy as to the length of the contract, but one thing is for sure. Vieira is a shrewd businessman picking this period in the season to negotiate his contract after two wins, and what's sure to be a good showing at Mugello this Sunday. For sure, with the emergence of Lorenzo as the great new Yamaha rider, Rossi was in shaky ground with regards to asking for his extremely high salary again prior to China. In fact, I think he might still have to take a bit of a cut. But definitely a good time for him to be negotiating his contract. And Lorenzo, speaking of whom, will be itching to spoil Rossi's party on Sunday in what will be his 100th GP race. That is a lot of races for such a young man. And Jorge said recently about his injuries, I've started walking without crutches, and in the gym I've started using the bicycle, and I am doing upper body weights. Now I can say that I am better than I was at Le Mans. To run, I am at 40%. On the bike, I am at 75%. Well, one would think that if he can do what he did in China at Le Mans at less than 75%, whatever that means, he's sure to be a major threat in the Italian race. I actually got a lot of feedback from listeners who tend to agree that Lorenzo is milking his injury. In the end, it doesn't matter, though. Bottom line is he's a very talented rider, a championship contender in his first year in the big class, and Lollipop and other carefully crafted characterizations or not, he's a very brave young man. But I'm guessing he's more like 88.3% fit. There's a hilarious photograph on MotoGP.com today of Alex De Angelis, Sylvain Guintoli, Tony Elias, along with Mattia Pessini and Simone Corsi, visiting a Tuscan bee farm. WTF is the only thing that comes to mind. But it's got to be seen, so I'll put that link in the show notes. Do check it out. It's pretty funny. And finally, more news on Ben Spies this week. He is now rumored to be talking to Ducati, as listener Kevin from Oregon alerted us to earlier this week. This is an interesting development, although it's hard to tell exactly the level of discussion that's been going on so far. Because both seats on the factory team are taken in 2009. The theory is that he would be going to the Alesia squad. Liam Schubert and Ben Spies on the same team sounds good to me. Although I have to say it's just as likely that unless Marco Melandri's results improve, that his contract could get short, and Ducati may be poking around for possible replacements. To be fair, though, it was Ben Spies, or rather his management, most likely, that approached Ducati, not the other way around. One has to assume that this could mean in turn that Suzuki's plans for running a third bike or a satellite team are not so likely, which is definitely a bummer. Okay, to wrap up the news section and taking advantage of the fact that I'm putting this thing together late, let's do a quick review of the action at Mugello so far. We've had free practice 1 and 2, and it's been raining. FP1 had a short dry period during which a dry line developed, and Kawasaki's John Hopkins took advantage and was a top man with a time of 1 minute and 54 seconds, just shy of 53. It was 154.053. And in the second session, the rain was very heavy, so no one came close to those times. Chris Vermeulen was on top with 2 minutes, 1.5 seconds, with Nicky Hayden second, about a half second back. And then Stoner and Rossi very close together, another quarter second back from Hayden. The Kawasaki guys were unable to repeat their morning performance. They were 12th and 14th. The good news for Yamaha was that free practice one, they were dismal, with Rossi best in 10th and Edwards dead last. In free practice two, full rain, they did okay. Tolson was fifth, just a 10th behind Rossi, Lorenzo 6th, another 10th behind James, and Edwards 9th, about 2 seconds off Vermeulen space. Pedrosa rounded up the top 10. So the weather is not looking great for QP or FP3, but we should have a dry race on Sunday, it looks like, which is actually pretty interesting because depending on how FP3 and QP go weather-wise, we could have teams doing a lot of guesswork setting up for the race. Mugello is my favorite round of the year. Always produces great racing, so it's kind of a shame to throw a randomizer into the works, but I'm sure we're going to have a great race regardless. Unless it starts raining halfway through the race. Okay, let's get on with the call to Liam Schubert. We talked a bit about Le Mans, and Magello, and as always, it's good to hear from Mother Liam. I do have to apologize for the quality of the call from my end. Something is seriously wrong with my gear, and it's causing crackling and stuttering when I'm using Skype. Thankfully, it's only on my side of the call, and Liam comes through very clearly. On to the call. Enjoy.
Okay, all right. We've got Liam Schubert on the line in Barcelona. How's it going, Liam?
Yeah, it's good. It's about almost 3 a.m., and I'm putting the finishing touches on prepping my bag and my gear for my trip to Mugello tomorrow. I'm flying into Fidenza, which is a beautiful, beautiful city. I wish I had more time to spend there, but it's the fabled home of Pinocchio. So when you get to the airport, you can find a Ferrari store and a Ducati store and a lot of little keychain trinkets with Pinocchio.
Right on.
Yeah. Then it's a picturesque drive through the hills of Tuscany, and really, it is a beautiful drive. I gotta admit, it's very green, and the hills are tall, and you kind of drive along the curves. I guess like some of the pictures of driving through the Alps that I've seen, it can be like that, but a little bit more high speed and bigger sweepers. And then we arrive to Mugello, and we'll be staying at a hotel I'm not familiar with. The last two times I've stayed there, we stayed in a converted old mansion or, you know, converted castle type structure.
Cool.
But I don't know. I'm excited because it's my first race working in MotoGP, and last year we got a podium. And that's been the highlight of my MotoGP career thus far, is getting a podium in Mugello. And I guess we're going to roll the dice and see what happens with Terrible Tony and Gin Tonic.
And Gin
see
Tonic.
What they're going to...
Nice.
We're going to see what they can do. You know, it's Ducati's home race, so maybe we'll have some extra special kick. And I'm hoping that you know, we can start to have some momentum this season.
Well, you guys almost got that momentum going in China with Tony.
Yeah. I mean, it was I don't know. For me, I don't like to count mechanicals and crashes.
Right.
I just think that they're a fact of racing, and I hate it when it happened to one of my guys. I think, oh, we had the pace to do this, and we were doing this, and for the most part, you know, barring a mechanical or a crash, you probably would have arrived at a certain point. Like, it's fairly predictable these days, especially the way they tend to split up into three groups and kind of proceed in a procession of the three groups. You know, generally, you have a chance to fight with 3 to 5 guys in your race. So you can improve a couple positions or lose a couple positions from your starting point. But as we saw from Lorenzo in previous races and Valentino and other people, you can fall back as far as 10th and still make it up into podium position.
I think Lorenzo, there are two races in a row, but especially amazing was in France because he did the, I think he took advantage of the fact that people were a little bit iffy about the grip after it started, you know, sprinkling. Mm.
He was he really went balls to the wall on that one.
Yeah.
That was a good race. I mean, I enjoyed that. That was Rossi. I mean, he went out there and just murdered everybody.
Yeah.
Like, the doctor was in surgery and it was all about the autopsy. you guys are dead already, and I just have to sit in my chair and do my thing, and you guys are done. And I don't, you know, we probably haven't seen a race that dominating since Pedrosa in 06 and Sachsenring, I think it was. And then before then would have been Rossi and Phillip Island.
Back in 2003?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those are kind of the kinds of performances that are really far and few between, when one guy can just, you know, decimate the field. It's one thing if two guys break away or three guys break away from the pack, because then they're all running at nearly the same level, and one guy's got a little bit more on them. on the lead group. But when one guy breaks off from everybody and leaves everybody in the dust, that's just...
And really, within just a few laps, I mean, it was amazing how much faster he was.
Yeah,
he was getting like a second a lap for a while. It was just insane.
Pedal to the metal.
Yeah.
And, I spoke with Colin a little bit that weekend because it was really good to see him on his game. And he was genuinely disappointed not to have done better, which I take as a fantastic positive. You know, it's one thing if he just comes in and goes, well, I gave it my all and third, all right, you know, got on the podium. But he was, thinking, fuck, I fucked up.
I think Colin's been unleashed, you know? I mean, it's like he's been kind of tethered to being the second, the sidekick to Rossi for the last 2 years, well, 3 years. And, and he, he's got a great team, great tires, and he's just like totally unleashed. So I see him, this could be the year he finally gets his win.
Yeah, definitely. He could get a win and maybe. He could finish the highest placed American in the series also. I mean, he's currently there now.
Yeah, yeah.
And, if the results continue, there's no reason why he can't be battling for a really good championship position, which is only going to raise his stock. And he wants to stay in the series, so.
Yeah, and Aprilia's coming back.
What's coming back?
Aprilia. It's Fiat? A rumor. Aprilia. Aprilia.
Yeah. I don't think they could come back in a year. It takes a little bit of development time.
But, I'm sure Colin's going to be waiting for that call from Aprilia.
Yeah. Shit happens. And it is prototype racing. I mean, it's not like you've got some test group that's pounding out 50,000 miles out of the machine, across the U.S. It's prototype racing. They could make it on Thursday and bring it to the racetrack on Friday and try something out.
Yeah.
So, I've seen things where I go, wow, I can't believe they're going to do that. And it works. That's a... we all do what we can to race.
So you guys had those French fairings in France. Is it going to be other international fairings coming up?
It's a possibility. I've heard some rumors about such things. I don't pay too much attention to the fairings of the bike unless they're broken and I need to source them. I mean, all I want to see is the numbers on the board. I like watching the pit board, and that's probably the most important thing, watching how much ahead the guy in front of us is and how far behind the guy behind us is and the position and the lap. And as far as the fairings, a lot of people really gravitate to the design of the bike. For me, it's the shape of the fairings more than anything.
Well,
and I find more that a lot of the designs that you see on the different factory bikes or private bikes, a lot of times for me, the designs kind of detract from the natural shape and beauty of the bike. And it's just, it'd be the same thing if you had a fancy car, a luxury car, and you put a lot of graphics and contrasting logos and... there's nothing beats like an all red car. That's the long and the short of that.
Definitely. I mean, the shape of these fairings is really important because you guys have probably one of the most aerodynamic packages, right, in the paddock.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if it's true right now. Yamaha changed their fairing last year. It looks, pretty similar as far as frontal space and general shape. And there's only so much you can do aerodynamically with the front of the bike and how much air you need to pass through the radiator. That's a bigger thing than I think people realize. You got to have big scoops on the side to draw air out that's passing through the radiator. Otherwise you're screwed.
I can imagine.
You know, so it's like a plus and minus. You want to have a small hole in the front of the bike to punch through the air, but it needs to be a certain size in order to be able to cool the bike, and it's all compromise. You know, everything.
You know,
you get this, you got to change that. It's amazing, the recipe.
At the International Motorcycle Show, they had Yamaha and the Ducati bikes from last year. The actual rider part of the cockpit, the little bubble, is really tiny on the Ducati.
It's really small.
Yeah, just the part that, I mean, the clear part.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all. You just need to look straight.
Do they actually even look? I mean, it seems like their heads are so low down. I mean, I just imagine that they probably have like an inch of visibility above the instruments and then below the top of their helmet, because their helmets are so low down.
Yeah, it is. I've always noticed that it's pretty small also. I think the training at that level comes in to just recognize your braking point, get on the brakes, and pop up out of the bubble as soon as you can, so then you can see more.
Right.
That's probably a question to ask one of the riders. There are some different fairing shapes out there. Let's see.
Well, the Honda's definitely quite different.
Yeah. Well, I want to see what their pneumatic bike looks like, because if it is an evolution of the current bike, then it'll just be an engine change, but it's quite possible that it's so much more than that. It could be an entirely new chassis and everything else, and the bodywork could look the same, but it could be completely different under the skin.
Well, they got to put all that pneumatic equipment somewhere, so they're going to have to change some things around, right?
Yeah, I would assume that they'd be able to do it all under the quasi, fake fuel tank.
Because that fairing actually is pretty small on the Honda. There's not much to hide under.
Yeah, it's pretty minimalist.
Yeah.
That's for sure. I like it.
Yeah, they're nifty. I mean, they were the first like 800s, even the first 800s that Honda showed. They were the ones that really looked different than the 990s did.
Yeah, it was the first real step away.
Yeah,
the Buell tail.
Yeah, that's right. The Buell tail and like the exhaust completely changed. It was just very, very. Although they kind of swung back towards the longer exhaust, I noticed.
I remember the first time I heard that bike in Motegi of 06, and I just, that thing screamed when it came down the racetrack. And then it changed, like, throughout that day. The sound changed, and you could tell they were trying various maps and engine tuning, and it never sounded quite the same to me as it did that first time.
Right.
I don't know. I remember hearing the last of the 990s, and I remember hearing the first tests with the GP7, the Screamer engine, in Brno in 06, and then later hearing the first Honda 800, and then pneumatic bikes, the pneumatic Suzuki in 06. And you remember the moment when you hear it the first time, and then you just hear it so much at work, running through pit lane or ripping around the racetrack, and you have to tune it out in order to get your job done. But the first time you hear one of these bikes, your ears stand up, and you go, oh, whoa, this is different.
Right.
And you program it into your recognized sounds, like the Kawasaki Screamer that they've been testing in various tests this year is... it's another level of 800, as far as the pitch and the way it makes your hair stand on end. But after listening to the test rider running around for so many laps, you lose it a little bit, because you've kind of tuned it out in order to focus on other things and focus on your job.
Sure.
Man,
sure.
That thing sounds incredible.
I've only heard YouTube videos, which are very, very poor sound quality. So I'm sure it's a very compressed version of what the real thing sounds like.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Right.
All these bikes are amazing. I think you can argue that superbikes, world superbikes in the current mode are you know, have the same or more horsepower, and it's still not the same. You know, that's the bottom line. You can stack both of those bikes, a superbike and a GP bike, next to one another, and with the superbike, you know you're looking at something trick and built. And when you look at the GP bike, you know you're looking at something special and really rare. They're really precious machines. I don't think people can understand the amount of backing that one of these machines has to create it. You know, if you think, okay, we use the Ducati, for example, just because I'm familiar with them. Let's say you've got a design staff of, you know, a couple dozen engineers, and so they're working with computer programs and computer drawings, designing the parts. Then you've got the fast fabricators that will mock things up. Then you've got the rough fabricators that will build, you know, the basic pieces of the bike. Then you've got all the subcontracted people and their entire companies that are making products that will go on this bike. And it just, you know, the spread of people that actually work somehow related to putting one of these machines together is huge. So if you see a really major crash, or like Pedrosa when he flamed the bike in Sepang and it caught on fire and everything was destroyed, knowing what little I do know about the logistics and the management of what it takes to gather all these parts from all these different companies and put it all together, and it's not just the time, it's the way the money gets juggled, because you got to order a certain quantity from this company, otherwise they won't even make it for you. You know, they're busy with F1 or whatever. It breaks your heart a little bit to watch one of these special bikes go up in flames, because they're so rare. And even though you can say, oh, I tested 10 different chassis this year, 10 different frames, you know, you count the bike as individual, like, yeah, there's only 5 of these bikes running around, and that's it.
Yeah.
And
I was always wondering what, because you're obviously the guy who procures the parts. Like, how do you do this in a one-off? There's so many parts that are one-offs, right? They're like, I mean, they're not one-offs. So you get a batch of 10 made, but they're totally custom parts. How much of the bike is actually not custom? Is there, like, percentage-wise, would you say?
How much of the bike is not custom?
It's not like custom parts, custom bits built directly for this particular machine.
Well, we use standard grips.
okay.
And a couple little, like, plastic fasteners and zip ties. Well, even our zip ties are special. We use, like, steel tooth zip ties rather than the standard plastic ones that you can buy at the store. How much of the bike is standard?
Like, is any part of the suspension, for example, shared between Ducati, Honda, Yamaha, or even, you know, street bikes? Sure.
Well, the forks could be interchangeable. You know, you just design your own triple clamp. The forks would be interchangeable. But other than that, like the rear suspension is only for Ducati. It's designed to work with the Ducati and fit the Ducati parameter. And it won't fit on any other bike. It wouldn't work with any other bike. It's something that Olin's made, developed specially with Ducati to work with this bike. There's really not a high percentage. Probably less than 10%, I would say, of the machine in total would be parts that we would use on other machines. And that's including all the nuts and bolts and hardware, because just in order to be cost effective and to be, you know, natural, you want to use normal bolts, you know, M6 by 10, M6 by 15, whatever,
right.
Different types of heads made out of titanium, something you can source. The bike is special. It's I don't even think I can figure out how much is could be used on another bike. I mean, I know certain pieces here and there, and I go, okay, if I can add up, you know, 10, 15 pieces on the bike, I know how many more than 1,000 pieces on the bike there are, and the percentage becomes less than 1%, you know. or whatever, and you go, holy smokes. That's a lot of people working on a bike that is not, you know, being sold to the public.
Well, that's what I was kind of getting at, is like all those people you were talking about, they're building not like a model that then is going to be duplicated, you know, hundreds of times. They're actually building just, you know, 5-6 bikes. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is a little crazy. And Ducati's unique in that they are selling their GP street bike, the Desmo Sedici RR.
Yeah, but they make like 200 of those, you know.
Well, even if they made a couple hundred of them, it's not, you know, from what I've seen of the bike with the fairings off, and I've crawled around it quite a bit when I was at the factory, it's really, really close. But it's not the exact same thing we're racing. I mean, it is slightly compromised. It did have to alter certain electronics and make space for the lights and change a few things around. The general architecture is right there. I mean, if you took that bike and unrestricted it and, you know, built a race engine for it and dropped it onto the grid in 03, you know, you would have had, you know, a pretty good race bike. But that's technology. I mean, I think you could do that with a lot of different bikes and put it on the grid from 5 years ago and have a competitive bike.
Right.
I honestly don't know enough about the internal engine components. I'm kind of surprised by the horsepower claims of the street bike. I go, why? Why does it? Where's the rest of the horsepower? Where did it go?
Regulations.
It is. It is, I think, for me, one of the most beautiful bikes that a person could aspire to own. I love the headlights on it. You know, it's a really unusual front fairing for a sport bike, and that it's so bulbous, and, you know, it's like the head of a bull shark.
Yeah.
And rather than go with your standard kind of headlight that was above the curve or set in a certain way, they really did something unique by putting the headlights with the mouth. And more than anything about the bike, more than the tail or the fairings, is the way the headlights match with the air intake. And I just think it looks incredible. There's not another bike out there that looks like it. And I'd love to own one day. I don't know if that's going to be feasible in my line of work, but it certainly is a trick machine.
They're only going to get rare. They're only going to get rare in the future, too.
Yes, people wad them up. Yeah. which I'm hoping happens. You know, I don't want these things to be living room queens, garage queens.
Yeah.
I'd like to see people riding them around.
Exactly. Although I'm sure there's a lot of, I'm sure there's like a very good high percentage of them that are not being ridden at all. They're just showpieces.
Yeah. You know. Maybe I'll be able to pick up one of those after some guy goes bankrupt one day.
There you
and
go.
Keep my fingers crossed. Definitely, there's not a lot of people in the U.S. that have worked on them like I have. I'm sure there are factory-trained guys, you know, working for Ducati dealerships and whatnot that have gone to the factory and learned about the bike and have 20, 30 years experience on me. I don't know. We're going to have to see, because it's quite a gamble for a small company like Ducati to say, oh, your maintenance is going to be covered for this, and whenever it's time to service the engine, you got to mail it back to us. And, you know, it's kind of wild when you think about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, they pay a lot of money for that. The customers. So
I'm surprised no one's come up with, like, a body kit clone of that. And just bought the headlights direct from Ducati and made like a bodywork kit for the current 1098 or a 999. Shit, I just gave somebody an idea, didn't I?
You just did.
Those would be sick.
So anyway, let's talk about Mugello.
All right.
So yeah, you guys had a great finish last year. That last lap, where Barros snuck past Stoner.
Yeah, we got past Stoner. Yeah, that was a really, really shining moment for this group of people, this team. And, you know, we've been clawing every race, and every week that we're not at the race, we're working. You know, that's the kind of thing we want to get back to. But definitely we feel the machine has the capability. And if we didn't feel the riders had the capability, we wouldn't be working with them. You know, Tony is a little bit in the woods right now, along with Sylvan. And it's weird, though, when you look at his history, what he's been able to pull out, just when you think, you know, he's totally out of it. He hasn't had a result all year or whatever. And then, boom, he wins the race in Estoril in 06. And you're like, where did that come from? Was it all just all the talk about his job next year or whatever? And I don't know. You know, I'm not paid to think about those things. And unfortunately, this year, since I'm kind of living through it, I don't want to think about those things. I just want to do my job and make sure my team is provided with everything they need. And, you know, just keep on trucking, because last year was a new bike, and so we had a lot of different problems, teething problems. You know, we were finding different things with the machine, how it was working in real life on the racetrack, week in and week out. This year, you know, it's an evolution. We're upgrading a lot of components. A lot of things are changing, and it's not obvious from the outside so much. You know, you wouldn't see, like, oh, you know, you obviously changed this. I could see it, you know, when you took the fairing off. Like, it's not stuff you can readily see. And, like, logistically, it's been kind of like a leapfrogging deal where they say, okay, we want to start doing this. We're going to start changing this more often. We want to start changing this less often. You got to adjust how much you want to order, plan for this percentage of the season towards, you know, the two-thirds mark of the season. We're going to do a review, and we'll check out how things have been working, if they've been breaking or if they're wearing out prematurely or whatever. You know, that's vital information for a factory that is testing products that they will eventually, you know, sell on the street bikes. So, I think for me this year, it's been a lot of kind of juggling that type of stuff. And it's less exciting than being a mechanic, that's for sure. You know, you have this charge when the bike comes in the qualifying session, and you know you've got 13 seconds to drop the rear tire and change it. And
when that kind of activity happens in the garage?
I'm about 10 feet away, just standing under the monitor watching the mechanics. And then if I see some shit go down wrong, then I'm running to get something to either fix it or if somebody drops the ball, I'll pick up the pieces and do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm technically not supposed to be getting my hands dirty this year. They've got different, you know, within our team, there's slightly different rules. Like, okay, it is this person's responsibility to do this and that person's responsibility to do that. And we don't want people, you know, even if everybody has the capability to do it, you know, it's preferred that for less confusion, if something goes wrong in the future, you want to be able to say, okay, that guy's hand was the last one that touched this. This guy touched that. You know, it makes things a bit more clear rather than if something goes wrong and you go, well, who did that? And everyone goes, I don't know. Was it you? Was it you? You know?
Really? You guys actually keep track of that, like have like a little blame system?
Something like that, yeah. I mean, as an example, Casey had the problem earlier this year where the camera equipment,
yeah, that's right,
Dorna equipment came loose in his bike. And I worked with that guy in the Qatar series back in early 06. So I knew what that mechanic was like. And I had my own thoughts about him. And, you know, I've always said that this is the kind of job where if you screw up, you're out. You know, it's not like we'll give him a second chance or depending on the level of the screw up, you know, you might stay around till the end of the season and then you're axed. And everyone knows that you screwed up in the paddock because we recognize all these screw-ups. Like, if one team does something and you see a mistake, you go, oh, man, somebody on that team fucked up. Well, sure enough, that guy did not come back to the races.
Wow.
And, you know, it was like pretty cut and dried. After the race, the bike came in, everybody pointed at the problem and said, that's messed up. And then, boom, that guy got the walking papers, you know, right then. So, it's a difficult, it really feels like at times you're here racing for passion. You want to do everything you can, and you want to be at your best, and you want to be in the top level, the world championship level of doing your job. And then you've got, you know, that kind of pressure of like, man, I can't make a mistake. Because one, it's life-threatening to the rider. Two, teams spend too much money paying for everybody, paying for shipping, paying for the bike lease, paying, you know, sponsors are spending millions. So if you screw up and the bike doesn't leave the garage, that's my fault. So I have a lot of pressure from that that I put on myself, because in my mind, I got to do whatever it takes to make sure that bike can leave the garage under any circumstances, whether it, you know, goes flipping down the road at 200 miles an hour, or the rider has a couple of low sides that weekend or whatever. It's, you know, just something it's a little stressful.
Yeah.
And then there's always the guy on your team or another team that thinks he would do a better job than you, or his friend would do a better job than you, or he knows that he's smarter than you, or whatever. So you've always got a little bit of political infighting and background shuffling, and that's never fun either, because you want to be able to count on your teammates, and you do. But at the same time, you know that not everyone is on your side on a team. And that's true of all teams. Every single one has its own internal drama and politics. And I guess that's kind of true of all working situations. You know, you might have different departments within a company, and there's always like little infighting within each department for power or whatever.
Yeah, you know, people have been fired over the wrong line of code.
I'm sorry, what was that?
In my industry, people have been fired over one line of code.
Yeah.
You know.
Whoa. Boom. You got the axe.
Yep.
It's just that it's kind of different in that I think if you work in the computer industry or one of the general businesses in the U.S., a white-collar job, you know, if you lose your job, there are a lot of other companies
out
there looking.
Say, you're not going to get blacklisted from the entire series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you get blackballed out of the GP paddock, like, that's it.
Yeah. You're probably going to have a tough time getting a World Superbike job or even an AMA job or such thing.
Well, I guess it depends on what happened, like what the true story is. But,
yeah.
You know, even if you took a year off from racing, you generally don't come back in. You know, if people don't see your face and see you working hard and they're not judging your work, even, you know, people on other teams are always watching other teams thinking, that guy's always working really well, always smiling or whatever. I think he would make this team better. So, it's a, you know, every day is like a job audition.
Well, Biagi came back.
Ooh.
Uh-huh. So, did you read the news about Nicky taking a lapse at Indy, at the Indy 500?
Yeah, actually, I thought that was great. What a great idea that was.
Yeah.
And I read the transcript on Soup, and I enjoyed the transcript. And it's funny, I kind of used to have this little joke that I would make, because I had some Nicky Hayden interviews on video on my computer, and I would think, man, he says, you know, a lot. And I listened to the last podcast earlier this week, the last one we did, and I was thinking, holy shit, I say, you know, a lot.
You do, dude.
So it changed my perspective a little bit. Well, I think I changed to you know because I consciously tried to stop saying,
Uh-huh.
Or,
Right.
you know, it just seems that much more hip and urban.
So let me ask you this, though. There's a rule that you can't test the tracks, right? So the writers can't test at certain tracks. And obviously, Nicky's not breaking any rules there, but because he's not going at anywhere near the pace. Although he did hit like 180 miles an hour. But he said he never really got the thing warmed up where he would have been able to take it at a real race pace. But
yeah, I don't think that counts as a test at all.
Last time he was there, he was on a street bike and on that Indian, which is actually super cool. But this time he was actually on the MotoGP bike. I was just wondering, that's no one's gonna say like, okay, he has a advantage because he went there. And he actually,
he's
ridiculous.
He's got 5 laps on everybody, or 10 laps, whatever. I don't think at this level it makes too much of a difference. These guys are all sharp enough and experienced enough that within a couple of laps they get the general lay of the land. And then the data guys look at the data after 5 laps and go, okay, we're topping out in third here. We want better drive out of here. We want this and that. And boom, then you change the transmission straight away. And you start fine-tuning the bike to work on the circuit at the race pace. And then suspension changes go from there. So you need to go in and out of the garage quite a few times to get the kinks out of the bike and get it set up for each racetrack.
Right.
Yeah.
But it was good to see he had the flag up. I don't know if you saw any photos. He did one lap with the flag, like the American flag, and
that was great.
We'll see.
That was really nice.
I'm very interested. I think it's going to be very, very telling to see what kind of turnout this race is going to get.
I'm not curious about the spectators myself.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the spectators. I'm actually curious as to how Ben Steves is going to do, because it'll be a new track for him, and it'll be his second time racing the Suzuki GP bike, so he should have some seat time, a couple hours of seat time. And as it's a new track, I'm sure we're going to get an extra hour of practice time, either on Friday morning. There'll be a two-hour session for us in the morning and a one-hour in the afternoon on Friday, something like that. I'm really curious to see what he's capable of. I think a lot of people are watching him this year.
Yeah. I think he's very well poised to make a move.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think an American has come around in a few years that has the capability to adapt to this championship. And I use that word adapt a lot. I've used it since the beginning when I got out here, because it's so different culturally and the circuits and the bikes and everything, the style of work. You're not in Texas anymore.
I guess that's the only
way to put it.
My theory has been for years that Hopper has been in a series early because he went straight to the top tier and never got to really get used to the life while winning races, you know. So he didn't, like, in the 125s to 50s, he may have had a better shot at, like, you know, actually scoring victories and while at the same time getting used to the life. And it's taken him a long time to get on the podium in MotoGP. I mean, he finally got there, but, you know, he's still a young guy. He's been in this sport for a long time. I mean, in this series, he's been in it for, 2002?
I think he's had like 100-something, just over 100 races now.
Yeah, he had 100, his 100th race was in China, wasn't it?
Yeah.
18,
30. This will be my 36th race.
Nice.
Yeah. Damn, they move fast.
Liam, I gotta cut it off because I have a hard limit. Unfortunately, I have to do a work thing.
Yeah, me too. I gotta pack my stuff and
get
some writing down. So I'll see you guys later. Probably we'll catch up in the next few weeks.
Thanks a lot for taking the time, dude.
No problem. Take care, Jules.
All right, ciao.
Bye.
Thanks, Liam. And thank you, everyone, for listening to MotoGP OD. Sorry about the delay on this podcast. Don't forget MotoGP is at Mugello this weekend, and I managed to make it through the entire show without saying nestled in the Tuscan Hills. Also, World Superbike at Miller Park in Utah. Thank you for all the comments on this last week, and keep them coming. Enjoy the racing, take care, be safe, and ciao.